What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valenti and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf on your flagship station for New York sports. The Fan, Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM, WFAN, New York.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Rick Wolf's Sports Edge. I'm your host, Rick Wolf. Well, on this morning's show, I want to do a long overdue clinic about sports psychology and, in particular, what sports psychology means to your young athletes. I'm here to answer any questions you may have on that subject. Now, look, I got to tell you, yesterday afternoon into the evening, look at all the extraordinary sporting events that took place. Tight games in the baseball playoffs with Cleveland rallying past the Yankees. Houston and Seattle going 18 innings before the Astros finally won. Tennessee knocking off Alabama on a last-second field goal, and on and on. And I have to tell you, in all these tight games, and they were all tight, sports psychology was in play everywhere. So, when did these athletes learn about the mental side of the game? And when? How old were they? For example, one of the first questions I always ask about sports psychology is, okay, what is the right age to introduce your youngster to this concept that in addition to all their physical practice in terms of improving their skills, what about the mental side of the game? I mean, how do you even explain the mental side of sports to young athletes? And as you do this, how do you let them know what to expect from this kind of, well, for them, from their perspective, a rather unusual kind of training? So, during the course of our conversation this morning, I want to see if I can add some real clarification to some of the more common misconceptions when it comes to this discipline, and obviously help to provide some helpful insights as well. In short, if you have questions about sports psychology, and again, I will give you a little brief background on the history of it, but again, I'm here to help you at 877-337-6666. Now, let's start this way. Let's draw a distinction between the physical aspects of developing one's skills in sports. I mean, you know, we're just talking about practice. And there's certainly no substitute for that. Even if your youngster was born with superior natural athletic ability, well, as they progress, he or she is going to definitely need to learn how to improve and to polish their skills, whether it's shooting a basketball or learning how to ice skate and skate backwards or how to find their right running rhythm when they're competing in a competitive road race. Whatever their sport may be, we all know they will need to work long and hard to get better and better. That's all a given. We all accept that. And usually this kind of idea of being introduced to working hard and practicing, that happens when a kid is perhaps, oh, maybe 5, 6, 7 years old and is first being introduced to sports. But we all know this, that in today's ever-competitive sports world, at some point, your youngster is going to find him or herself in a tight, pressure-packed moment. Now, again, keep it all in perspective. There aren't that many pressure-packed moments when a kid is 8 or 10 or 12 years old. But if they don't know how to cope or to react with that kind of pressure, or they aren't prepared for these kind of moments, well, that can put them back a little bit. I mean, to me, when it comes to sports psychology, it's like sending your kid to take a major test in school, but they really haven't studied or prepared for that exam as well as they could. And if they aren't prepared to take that test, most likely they're not going to do very well on it. And it's as simple as that. That's where developing a sense for the mental side of sports becomes critical. Now, again, as noted, I've been watching the Major League playoff games, all sorts of pressure-packed moments. Pitchers who absolutely have to throw strikes with the bases loaded. Batters who have to make contact with a pitch coming at 100 miles an hour. Infielders and outfielders being constantly on their toes in order to make key defensive plays. For most top athletes, they really do seek a mental approach in order to become more consistent in their performances. And that's the key I want to really hammer home. They're looking for a sense of consistency. They want to basically even out the highs and lows of their game. They want to get to a point where pretty much every performance is at the same very high level. They do not want any unexpected bad days. And they do believe that developing their own mental approach can help provide that kind of assurance to them. And this, for lack of a better phrase, this mental protection system, it's especially important during the critically important parts of each contest. Now, again, as I've mentioned to you before in the show, I when I was in college at a top Division I baseball program, sports psychology back then not only didn't exist, it was clearly looked down on and, quite frankly, disparaged. And as a serious athlete myself in college, I got to tell you, I searched high and low for anything I could find on the subject. And quite frankly, there was very, very little in the libraries on sports psychology. Fast forward to 1989, the only sports psychology coach in Major League Baseball was Harvey Dorfman. And Harvey, who basically reached out to me, explained that a number of big league teams were looking for a sports psychology expert. I ended up signing a contract with the then Cleveland Indians, now, of course, the Guardians. But in those days, the Indians were the laughing stock of baseball in the early 90s. You remember the movie Major League, Wild Thing? Yeah, that was the Indians back then. But the front office of John Hart and Dan O'Dowd knew that they had a very, very clever and smart plan to build on their minor league stars. And that plan included the introduction of sports psychology to their players. And that's where I came in. In the 1990s, sports psychology in pro baseball was a totally new concept. The ball players in the Indians minor league system at that time, guys like Manny Ramirez, Jim Tomei, Albert Bell, and so on, this was an aspect of the game that they wanted to know more about. And so they took the mental side of the game seriously. The bottom line? Well, within just a few years, the Indians were a dominant powerhouse in the American League in the 90s. And now fast forward, these days, well, it's the rare sports team or professional or college organization that doesn't have at least one sports psychologist on their staff. Okay, let's talk about this because, as I said, it's changed so dramatically, so fast, that it's hard to sort of keep up with all that's going on. And again, there's a lot of misconceptions about what this is all about. Let's start our conversation this morning. Let's go to Ed Ward over in Jersey. Ed, good morning. You're up in the fan.
Rick, this is Robbie from Lake Success.
Oh, Rob, I'm sorry. How are you, Rob? Oh, we're having some technical issue here. Let's see if we can get Ed Ward back on the from Elizabeth. Ed? He dropped. Okay, well, okay. I'll tell you what we do. Why don't we start with our good friend Jack Smithlin over in Fairlawn, see what Coach Smithlin has to say about sports psychology, because I know that's a pretty big, important subject to him. Jack, good morning.
How are you, Rick?
Good morning, Jack.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, sir. Yes, sir.
How you doing? Very, very important. Very important. In fact, if people want to actually learn about it, and I know you're going to get upset with me here, but they should read your book. Stop. Don't laugh. The Secrets of Sports Psychology, people. It's actually one of the best, if not the best, because it's in layman's terms. But he talked about Harvey Dorfman, who wrote the book, The Mental Game of Baseball. And, yep, you know, that was my Bible until I actually picked up Rick's book years ago. And that became my Bible. And it's in layman's terms, so it's very easy to understand. But, you know, one of the things you talked about there for a couple minutes was about when should we teach our kids. Well, here's my theory on that. When you think they're capable of learning it. You know, and you got to, at the younger ages, you got to teach it in a way that they don't even know they're being taught it.
Correct.
So, you know, and I've been studying this for a long, long time now. I've read hundreds of books on the topic. Two sons that played college ball, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I implemented it in their lives. They both followed it very well. Alex is a good golfer, and Zach played 8 years of professional baseball. But, you know, one of the things that you should teach your kids first is that failure is a very, very important part of the game. And to not fear it. You can't fear failure. If you fear it, it will eat you up and spit you out. It really will. And, you know, when you talk about kids being young and being in a pressure situation, you're absolutely right. They should not be in a pressure situation, but they are because their coaches and their parents put them in that position. So, you know, and they want to please everybody. I mean, they want to please their coach, their teammates, you know, teaching them, you know, I mean, visualization might be a little bit far-fetched at this point in their lives.
Right.
But if they're capable of learning it, teach it to them. Teach them how to think positive. Speak to themselves in a positive manner rather than, oh, I hope I don't strike out. You know, get up to the plate and say, I'm hitting this next pitch. You know, there's so many things we can do. And your book, and I'm sorry, Rick, but your book explains it all. It explains it all. It takes a kid from when he's a little kid and brings him right up into the college years, ready for college ball. And the things that I've learned from your book are just extraordinary.
Well, so, Jack, I mean, yeah, people are going to think this is an hour show infomercial for my book. I appreciate your,
I'm sorry about that.
Wonderful comments. But I do want to come back to what you just talked about. Yes. One of the questions I posed this morning was, what's the right age to teach kids about the mental side of sports? And I think I want to be clear about this. For most youngsters, while they can be somewhat aware or hear about the mental side of the game, it's not really going to have a real impact on the way they cognitively approach their sport until probably maybe they're 14 or 15. I mean, by the time they're, you know, through middle school into high school, because at that juncture, they're going to begin to realize there's a lot of competition out there, because in the early years, they just want our kids to go out there. We want them to have fun, to enjoy the whole idea of playing sports on a team or individual sport, whatever. But the thing is, and this is what I want to hammer home, we all parents, we tell our kids to go out and have fun when they go out to play in a game when they're 6 or 8 or 10 or 12. The problem is the kids obviously are watching their parents, and the parents are on the sidelines going nuts and pacing back and forth, or clearly are in distress about how their kid is not performing well. The kid picks up on those cues, and the kid begins to start getting a sense of this of anxiety, of nervousness, that perhaps they're not doing as well as they should be doing. And we want to get away from all that. We want the kids to know, when we say to them, go out and just have fun, we want them to go out and have fun. We can worry about pressure-packed situations and dealing with the ups and downs of the game later on. But, again, it's about having fun at the early ages. The mental side can wait until they're old enough to understand exactly what it's all about. Jack, I'm sure you feel the same way.
Well, I definitely feel the same way. But, you know, one of the things that you talked about in your book is that when athletes look for, and back in the day, you know, years ago, that like when you were playing ball, there was no such thing as, you know, as mental preparation. Even though it was out there, nobody ever talked about it or wrote about it.
Right.
So what a lot of players do is, and I've witnessed this every single day in my career, you know, I'm heading to a doubleheader right now. We have our fall doubleheader today. And, you know, one of the things that one of the girls texted me last night, I was at a bar mitzvah, my God, but, you know, and they said to me, they said to me, where's your words of inspiration, coach? I said, no inspirational speech tonight, ladies. All I'm going to do is tell you that tomorrow, relax and go out and have fun. That's all. Have fun. Play with a state of mind that nothing matters other than hitting the ball and having a good time doing it. You know, and when they pressure themselves, and kids do pressure themselves.
No question.
You know, and like you just said, the parents and the coaches. I've witnessed just recently an 8-year-old fall T-ball game. I mean, come on. I mean, the kid should be playing soccer or football, or, you know, I mean, I'm not a football person, but, you know, some other sport. But playing full, you know, all around year at 8 years old, that's ridiculous. And I watch the parents screaming at the kids, and the coaches saying, come on, come on. What, are you kidding me? Just go out. Didn't even have umpires, a T-ball. What, are you kidding?
That's what we're talking about.
Part,
yeah.
Oh, man. It's just ridiculous.
That's where the pressures, the kids become sensitive that they're somehow letting their parents down and not doing well in T-ball at age 8. And they haven't even mastered the ability to catch a ball or to hit a ball or to throw. I mean, it's just silly. What they're learning is that they should be doing something better than they're currently showing, and the parents are unfortunately being critical. And that's not a good formula for success. Jack, I got to take a break. Let me jump off here, but thank you as always for your call, and of course, thank you for your nice words about my book. I very much appreciate that. You know, we're talking this morning about sports psychology, and I just want to drive this point home, friends. You as parents, you sort of set the tone when it comes to your kids. You got to get them to understand that, yeah, this is any sport does take physical practice, takes dedication, takes time and effort to begin to master these skills, but you're not doing your kids any favors if you start basically yelling and screaming on the sidelines when they're only 7, 6, 7, 8 years old. That doesn't help in terms of their mental ability to try to master the sport. Okay, let me take a timeout. 877-337-6666.
It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valenti, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch. From the best bets to the sneaky underdogs, and of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket. Follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back here on the Sports Edge, I'm doing a kind of a mini clinic on the topic of sports psychology this morning, and I'm trying to sort of clear up any misunderstandings about sports psych. You know, let me just start. We were talking before the break about little kids and what's the right age to introduce this topic to them. Look, let's understand this. When it comes to sports psychology and little ones who are just beginning to understand, grasp the concept of a sport, they're trying to master the skills, they're trying to understand the rules. I'm talking about kids who are 6, 8, 10, 12 years old. These are very young kids. There's not much of a situation where you really want to focus on the mental side. Rather, the issue that comes to mind, and Jack Smith just mentioned this, and that has to do with the fact that you know, kids learn at a fairly young age about winning and losing. They understand if they've done well or they haven't done well. You as the parent, you have to be there to give them unconditional support, because they're going to turn to you and say, well, our team lost today, or I struck out, or I made an error, or I didn't do well, or I did well, maybe I got a hit. The point is, you have to sort of gradually and gently explain to them about winning and losing, and let them know in particular, because when, you know, a kid wins, they're pretty happy. The kid does well, they're happy. But if they didn't do well, you know, you just, on the moment that happens, the day of the game, when they're coming home with you in the car, you just explain to them that, well, you did fine, you made some nice plays here, you did this. Try to find those situations, what they did today, that they can point to and you can point to with some pride. I was so pleased that even though you struck out, you just basically hustled out to the field right away. You didn't sort of, you know, get depressed. You didn't be in a situation where you sort of let know that it bothered you. Just let them know that you are there for them and come up with some sort of specific positive feedback for them. But the next day, when the kid has moved on to other activities in their life, that's where you can start explaining to them about, you know, when you play sports, sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And the key to understanding losing is to try to figure out what I can learn from that defeat. What do I need to work on to get better so it doesn't happen to me again? Because, again, this sounds like this basic stuff. But, again, if you're talking about little kids, they don't know any of this stuff. Nobody's ever sat down and talked to them about this. So that's your job, to explain to them the beauty the wonderful part about being in a situation where you lose or you didn't do well, you didn't play well, is that you can then, a day after the sting of that loss or that defeat, then you can sort of focus in on what you can do to get better. And that's where you start introducing the concept of the mental side of the game. And again, it's very gentle. It's very, very easy. You don't make a big deal about it, but start introducing to your son or daughter that, you know, winning is great. We all want to win. But the thing about losing or not doing well or not performing up to one's best is that you can then sort of objectively think about what can I do so I can play better. And that's really the first stop when it comes to sports psychology. And again, this stuff didn't exist 30, 40 years ago, but it does now. And again, it's all about how you handle it as a parent. Let them know that you're there for them. You're fully supportive of what their efforts are. But bit by bit by bit, you start to explain to them, this is how you can improve your game by going back and trying to sort of, in their own little youthful way, try to dissect and analyze how they can get better. All right, let's get back to our calls at 877-337-6666. Let's go to Ed. Ed over in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Ed Ward, good morning.
What did I do, Rick, to get cut off? Am I on the bad side?
Ed, you got to pay your phone bills, pal. What can I tell you?
I hear you. No, this is a great topic. And one of the things I always tell my players coaching, and I'm actually heading down to a game right now to coach.
Yep.
To be good, you got to know how to fail. And, again, that comes with, you know, the proper coaching, and even the parents have to understand that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've had times where, you know, some of my players, maybe in big situations, have struck out or whatever, you know. And I told them, I said, look, I still want you up in that situation. Just have confidence or put the ball in play. And another thing that I do, in situations where we got first and third, no out, I tell my players, I don't care if you hit a ground ball double play. Now, people may say, why are you saying that? Because if you get a ground ball double play, we got to run out there, we scored a run, you know, and I put those things in my players' head so they don't understand that they're a failure and all that. And
right.
You have to be positive with the kids, but yet they got to understand, you know, how to lose. I mean, it just can't be, oh, well, we lost and all that stuff. They got to understand the things that they have to work on to make themselves better players. And not only that, parents have to understand that too, because a lot of parents today, they're looking for the big picture down the road when the big picture down the road hasn't even come up yet.
Yeah, that's true, Ed. And we understand all this, of course, the fact that the parents, of course, have big dreams for their kids. But to your point, you know, sports, and nobody likes to talk about that openly, but sports is about failure. And the smart, the good athletes are the ones that realize that they can learn from failure. The ones that sort of deny it or just try to, you know, get angry and frustrated and don't cope with it, they're not going to get any better. They have to understand that you're going to fail in whatever sport you take, whether it's baseball, softball, whatever, ice hockey, basketball. You got to learn from what your shortcomings are and somehow find a way to improve. And that's where it comes to, again, the mental side. Ed, thank you for your call this morning. Appreciate it. You know, and I got to tell you, friends, let's take this a next step beyond this. Okay, so we talked about the kids from ages 6 through, let's say, 12, 13, 14, and they are into sports, and they are beginning to understand as they get a little older, you know, into middle school, that they're going to have some good games and not so good games, and they're beginning to hear that, yeah, I guess I have to improve this to get to the next level, to get beyond, you know, the competition. Okay, so now they're into 14, 15 years old, and they're old enough now to understand some of the things that sports psychology is all about. And again, you can try to tell your kids when they're 6 or 8 about this stuff, but I don't think it's going to have any impact. They're just not going to understand this. But by the time they're in high school, they will understand this because they're looking for any advantage they can get when it comes to their game. You know, when I got to tell you, when I was working with Cleveland, my specialty was trying to get the ball players to really sort of understand how their mental approach could improve their game. Now, the mental game, just to be very clear, these techniques, they do not work overnight. They take a long time, as with any skill, to learn, to adapt, and to make them part of a ball player or an athlete's routine. For, again, like stress in a game. You know, when a kid is in a game and they're in the heat of action and they realize that there's a lot of pressure on him or her to perform, sometimes traditionally coaches just go out and they say, oh, just take a couple of deep breaths and refocus. Well, that doesn't really work that well because it doesn't really tell the kid what to do. I spent a lot of time working with ball players, professional ball players, to basically say, look, you're going to have to, before when you get to the ballpark, try to find or select what I would call a focal point somewhere in the ballpark. It could be the American flag in the outfield. It could be a sign on the outfield wall. But find something that is unique and singular to you. So when you get to a tight pressure in the game, you know, you've already trained yourself to say, when I look at that flag or I look at that sign on the outfield wall, that's my cue to say, okay, I'm going to just clear my head of all distractions, clear my head of anything that's bothering me at all. I just want to basically use that to remind myself for a few seconds just to clear what I want to do and be very, very clear about what I want to accomplish when I'm on the mound or at the plate. You know, it gives the chance to the athlete to basically slow down the game. I mean, there's a natural inclination when there's pressure on somebody to speed everything up. But what you want your athlete to do is to slow everything down. And again, this kind of technique of finding a focal point well before the game begins and knowing that focal point is your quote-unquote friend, it's your mental friend when things get tough, you can use that so that it can be used in pretty much any time in any sport. But again, it's up to the athlete to understand and to trust their athletic ability. So when they look and they find that focal point, then they know they are on the right track. Because again, you've now gone through a process of training your mind to basically say, okay, I'm in a tight spot, but I'm not concerned. I'm not worried because, quite frankly, I've worked so hard to get to this level that I now am able to trust my athletic instincts. And again, you've heard this before. You know, you have to basically clear your head of distractions. And as, you know, you hear the expression in sports, when you think, you stink. What that means is that you want to be able to just basically go to autopilot and trust your body to do what you've been training your body for years and years in terms of athletic ability. I mean, from baseball perspective, as Yogi Berra once said so eloquently, you can't hit and think at the same time. In other words, as you progress as an athlete, you have to learn how to trust your own athletic ability. Let your body do its work. Let your automatic pilot take over. So there's no real, you're not going to be involved with pressures and thinking about this and that. I mean, if you watch the pitchers in the playoff games, they throw strikes. I mean, you take a kid like Seattle's George Kirby out of Rye High School. I mean, it wasn't that long ago I was watching George Kirby pitch for Rye against my local high school, Byram Hills. And, you know, the kid, you could tell, had great mechanics, had great velocity, but he was clearly had such great mental discipline, and he continues to this day, he doesn't throw any balls. He doesn't walk anybody because he's trained his body to say, I trust my arm and my mechanics to just throw strikes. And that's what we're talking about here. I mean, it's as simple as that. We're talking about how do you train your body to basically take over during the tight times. And I'll tell you, that to me is so critically important on this. All right, let's take some more calls because obviously you can tell I can lecture at this for a long time. Let's go to Coach Tom over in North Arlington. Tom, it's good to hear from you.
Hey, good morning, Rick. How you doing?
I'm well, Tom. How are you doing?
Okay, great. You know, it's funny because, and again, I don't coach now anymore, but all the years I coached basketball and baseball, listening to what you just said, I was actually doing sports psychology, didn't even know I was doing it. Seriously, I really feel good about it. My big thing was we used to always, work hard in practice and drill that into them and explain to them. Game is just like a test in school. Once you've prepared, there's nothing else you can do except make sure you've got good rest. You know, you get there, and then, you know what? you trust your body, just like you said. You got muscle memory. You put all those time and hours into it. Relax, trust your body, and enjoy the ride.
Yes.
You know, like when you're in there, when you're shooting a free throw and everybody's screaming, you look, instead of worrying about concentrating on it, just look around and enjoy it. You know, and the other thing I used to always say was, I think I got it from Michael Jordan, concentration is the ability to think about nothing.
Correct.
You know, that was, and just what you said, my thing was, like you say, key on a flag or something like that. Every one of these guys, including a kid I tutor now, their parents are constantly screaming instructions at them. Especially before they get up at a bat. You know, in baseball, when it says the time for extreme concentration. And my thing was, okay, after your parent tells you something, yes them, okay, and that's your key to think about nothing. You know, and I some of the people was like, oh, it's great, because I can't wait for my father to scream at me. It really focuses me now, you know. And you know, and then afterward, you know, the other thing was, we had a bumper sticker or saying that was, some days there are good days, and there are days you learn things. And just like you said, there's failure. I mean, look, I'll give you a typical. There are days you don't fail when you lose, because sometimes the other team just wins. Look at the Yankee game as typical, like last night. Pitcher comes in, gives up a couple of loop hits. You know, that's not a failure on the pitcher.
No.
Pitcher did what he had to do. And the batter, guess what? He just made contact. He did what he had to do. Sometimes it's just – and when you're pro athletes, the difference, and obviously you know this, between, you know, failure and success is inches and sometimes tenths of a second and even less. So once we trust our bodies and think about nothing, it actually becomes fun.
He's mentioned about Michael Jordan, Tom. I remember having a conversation with Jim Thome, the Hall of Famer, when he was in low minors, A ball or double A, with the Indians. And I remember asking Jim, you know, who was a terrific all-around athlete. He was such a great basketball player in high school that he was recruited by Bobby Knight when Knight was coaching Indiana. But Jim said to me, when I go to the plate, I consciously think about nothing. I just clear my head. All I want to do is see if it's a good pitch to swing at, either swing or don't swing. And that, to me, is what you're talking about here. He trusted his athletic ability. You mentioned about muscle memory. Yes, of course, but to get to muscle memory, that's all about the physical practice of repetition over and over and over again. But once you get to that point where you know you got it, then you just trust your body and go on automatic pilot, because your body will do all the heavy lifting for you. You don't have to worry about, you know, your mental preparation, because it's already been done. It's as simple as that.
It's all trust. Just like you said, it's trust. If you trust your body, it's relax. And if you don't trust your body, there's nothing I can say to help you.
That's exactly right.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Tom. Good to talk to you. Now, tell your friends, this is good advice being put forth this morning by our callers. This is all good stuff. And again, if you have a kid who wants to be an athlete and be good at it, pay attention to what we're talking about here with the mental side of sports. All right, let me take a pause. When I return, we'll continue our conversation, and we'll take more calls at 877-337-6666. Welcome back to the Sports Edge, everyone. Jack Smithlin, he was very, very nice of him. And trust me, folks, it's all unsolicited, but he did mention my book, Secrets of Sports Psychology Revealed, which obviously is very pertinent to what we're discussing this morning. You can find the book. It's on Amazon. That's the fastest way to get it. You can either buy it as a print book, an e-book, or also as an audio book. But again, Secrets of Sports Psychology Revealed. I really try to write the book so that it's not full of psychological jargon or mumbo-jumbo, but it's meant to be read by athletes who are serious about trying to find out more about to improve their mental game. Anyhow, it's out there. I also want to take a moment to pause and send my sincere condolences to the family of Corey Phelan, the young, talented Philadelphia Phillies pitching prospect who sadly succumbed to a rare form of cancer this past week. By all accounts, Corey, who was only 20 and a graduate of Harbor Fields High School out in Long Island, true competitor, gentleman, and a very, very popular fellow and teammate. And I just feel for his parents and his friends. What a terrible, terrible loss, Corey Phelan. Okay, moving on. Oh, before we get back to your calls, I just want to... Quick sidebar. Let me get something off my chest. You obviously know I'm a baseball fan, have been all my life. There's been so much discussion in recent weeks regarding Aaron Judge and his chase of the home run record, and in particular the ongoing debate about whether there was ever an asterisk placed next to Roger Maris's record when he hit 61 home runs to break Babe Ruth's home run record. Let me be as crystal clear as I possibly can. There was never, ever any asterisk next to Maris's record. And for those younger baseball fans, let me explain. When Maris hit his record-breaking homer, he played during a major league season of 162 games. When Babe Ruth played, the season was only 154 games. So obviously Maris had an extra 8 games. So there's always been some real and vigorous debate dating back to the early 1960s as to whether there should be some sort of mark or asterisk placed next to Maris's record since he played in a longer season than Ruth did. And this was curious because the commissioner at that time, Ford Frick, suggested that maybe there should be an asterisk or mark placed next to the Maris record. But the truth is, that comment from Ford Frick, commissioner at the time, it never really caught on. It just didn't happen. Now, the reason I know this is because I had the privilege of serving as the editor of the Baseball Encyclopedia for 3 separate editions. The Baseball Encyclopedia, for those who are too young to remember it, was a mammoth 3,000-page book, which was the statistical Bible of every player who ever played in the big leagues. It was the book. And everybody who was a true baseball fan back in the day had a copy of the Baseball Encyclopedia. And, of course, it recorded Ruth's HR as well as Maris's HR stats. And I can personally assure you that there was never any asterisk or any kind of mark ever placed to Roger Maris's record-breaking home run record. Never. Again, as the book's editor for 3 editions, I would have known if there was any mark next to Maris's name, and there never was. So, again, over the last few weeks as I've read sports columns and listened to sports talk, I fear that the truth of this matter has been somehow shaded or warped over the years. And as such, I just felt compelled this morning to try and set the record straight. The bottom line is this. If anybody ever brings up the so-called Maris asterisk up to you, just stop them in their tracks. Stop the conversation right away. There was never any asterisk at all. Forget any sports columnists who write that. Forget all the other baseball stat books. The Baseball Encyclopedia ruled the baseball world for more than 50 years. Everybody who was a baseball fan had a copy. And there was never any asterisk ever printed next to the Maris HR record. And there won't be any asterisk ever placed next to Aaron Judge's HR record as well. Okay, let's get back to our calls about sports psychology. And again, forgive me for getting my soapbox today, but this has bugged me for a long time. I don't know why this conversation even takes place anymore. There was never any asterisk next to Roger Maris's name. End of story. All right, let's go to Rob Fried. Rob, good morning. You're on the Fan.
Rick, good morning. I'm glad I got back. I do have a copy of one of those books, by the way, from the 70s. And like you said, it's like, I don't know, like 3,000 pages. Those are tremendous books of the past. I've been doing some thinking. Number one, the station was, this particular station was basically for fanatics, okay, to call and go nuts and talk about sports talk. And this is the complete opposite. What we do as callers, as fans who call into the station, we rant, we rave, we critique. This is the complete opposite of what athletes should be doing. This is for us to rant and just speak because the Yankees aren't even eliminated yet, and they're having funerals already. I mean, they might lose today, they might lose tomorrow, but sports talk is very, very different when it comes down to actual participation and psychology.
Yep.
And going to the ages is what you were talking about earlier. I think what you hit on earlier, at a very young age, pre-puberty, that's fine, okay? Introduce sports to kids. let them learn participation, learning a little bit about hand-eye coordination. But by the time you get to puberty already and participating at, let's say, in high school, the better athletes already understand all of this. And kind of like what the callers have gone into, at that point already, they're honing their skills, they're getting ready for the next level. One of the things that I think we touched on, what you were touching on in my particular sports background, is visualization.
Yep.
Every single race, as well as even training, I have a plan. I plan out what I'm going to do. If I'm going to, let's say, participate for the New York City Marathon, Boston Marathon, you can't think, oh, they're going to run 26 miles today and compete for, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 hours of being out there. That's a long time. I break it down to segments. I say to myself, okay, let think about the first 4 or 5 miles, where I want to be. What type of time split do I want to kind of hit at that particular point? Because if you think about it, it's a mammoth, type of a situation.
Oh,
you got to break it down into very small segments. And failure, Rick, I think that is something that is so important. You learn so much from failure, because in baseball, and I know this is what we talk about, especially this time of the year, if you hit 333, okay, that's 1 out of 3 times you're going to get a hit. You're failing 2 out of 3 times, and if you hit 333, you're the champion of your league, okay? So failure is so important. Preparation is so important. Visualization going forward. And I think all coaches, parents, should pick up your book and learn about psychology, and each athlete should learn. I think this is something going forward, because sports, Rick, you could take all this into life, because really sports is life, okay? If you use the tools of participation and, you know, competing, it's really what life is all about. And that's really what I wanted to share today, because I think this is a fabulous topic.
I tell you, I agree, and what you just said, Rob, I couldn't agree more, and it was obviously said very, very eloquently, and I thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, we want our kids to use sports as sort of a springboard to learn life lessons, and yeah, unfortunately, life is full of failure, but we accept that as adults, but we know that as adults, that we have to understand what we can learn, what's the takeaway that can make us help improve our approach to life and to our careers and to our families. Kids, you know, you mentioned about, and Rob, thank you as always for the call. Visualization, well, that's obviously a key of this. That's all about the process of developing a sense of what you want to accomplish and learn about muscle memory. And that's really something that I would think kids, by the time, I'd say they're 15 or 16, that's the age where they can start getting into visualization and how you develop that and how you get into a routine. Just as Rob was saying, that it's all about the advanced preparation. And that's what visualization comes into play. Again, that wasn't even known 30 years ago, but it's pretty commonplace today. The issue I find with most young athletes is they don't understand. You don't just do it once or twice. You got to make visualization like almost like a everyday part of your routine, so that your body really accepts the fact that you will get better and you are going to go through a sense of muscle memory and you are going to visualize what that game is going to be about, and you're going to see in your mind's eye yourself succeeding over and over and over again. And again, you know, this has become routine, not just here in the States, but all over the world. And again, as your athlete climbs the pyramid of competition, they always are looking for something other advantage to get them better. And the mental side of the sport, whether it's tennis, ice hockey, baseball, you name it, this is what they need to understand that will get them better and make them better so they can trust their body. I mean, I was thinking about Justin Tucker. Justin Tucker is the superstar field goal kicker of the Baltimore Ravens. He's the most accurate kicker in the game today. I mean, you can't think of any sort of this. He just, his job is to go out and kick field goals. Well, he's almost as close to anyone being perfect. He's better than like 91-92% accuracy. And I heard he was interviewed the other day on the Today Show, and Justin Tucker, who I don't think was even drafted out of the University of Texas. I could be wrong, but I don't think he was even drafted by the NFL. But basically, he knows what he has to do to basically crush and push and suppress his emotions during the course of a game. Yeah, he sees all his teammates scoring touchdowns, big comebacks, whatever, but he knows at the end of the game is where he makes his money. So he's always trying to make sure he stands off to the side. He's isolated. He obviously doesn't go into great detail about how he does all this in terms of basically having his focal point, but he's learned and trained himself to know how to keep his emotions out of the game. He just wants to go out there and trust his leg and trust his constant practice. So he goes out there and it's just as routine as anything. And obviously, it's worked, and it's worked for him for a good long time. Let's go quickly to some other calls here. Let's go to Scott from Morristown over in Jersey. Scott, good morning. You're next up on the Fan.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me this morning. This is a topic really near and dear to my heart as someone in the early 90s who received a master's degree in sports psychology.
Great.
I've been able to use that experience in the last 25 years coaching my daughters and various other youth sports teams. One played D1 in basketball, one decided not to play in college, and one's currently playing D3. So I kind of covered my bases and have a good cross-representation there. But one observation I'd like to make, and it's been touched upon, is, when I have parent-coach meetings, of course you have the bureaucratic, here's the time of the practices, here's the expectations of, students playing time at whatever age group it might be. But then I really dwell on making sure the parents, and it's been touched upon, but, that they get they understand the mental part of the game and the influence they have with their child, and that they need to provide positive reinforcement, positive affirmations with constructive criticism. And I call it sort of the sandwich method, right? Mm-hmm. Feedback, whether coaches do this. One quick study we did back in the day with the Masters is we watched coaches feedback three college football teams, just the outside linebacker position. And then we would record literally the positive feedback versus the negative feedback, and lo and behold, the results showed that those players graded out much higher over the course of the season with the positive feedback. And so from a parent and a youth sport level, just keep it sandwich method. Positive comment, constructive feedback in the middle, and you end on a high note with a positive comment, and get out of the way and let your child just feel that you're ending with positive notes even though you're constructing them. And so that they can clear that mind and just leave it up to the coaches to get their performance.
Scott,
that's worked quite well for me recently with the parent meetings, and I've seen some results with the parents along the way with that.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, Scott, because the praise sandwich is something which has become very useful, very commonplace. I've been talking about the praise sandwich for years and years on the show, and it's very, very helpful with little kids because they do look to mom and dad for positive feedback. In fact, even going back to the days of Coach John Wooden, who's considered, of course, to be one of the greatest coaches of all time, they did some studies about Coach Wooden. He would always give out, and this was done deliberately, four to five lines of praise for every bit of constructive criticism he gave to his players at UCLA, because Coach Wooden knew that the best way to connect with your players is by giving them praise. They will pay attention when you start giving them good positive feedback. And then occasionally you put in something that may be something useful to help them improve their game. But there's no question at all, Scott. I think this is something that parents need to understand. And unfortunately, a lot of them just don't. They just don't get it. But they want the kid to get better at the game. The irony is you have to basically be there and be constructive in your comments with the praise sandwich to let them know that they can get better, but they look to you for that kind of positive support. Scott, thank you for that call. Let me go quickly over to Jimmy in Hopewell Junction. Jimmy, are you there?
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Good. Jimmy, we've got about 1 minute here, so go quickly, my friend.
Okay, so The mental performance is probably the most neglected part of training that most coaches, they neglect it. There's just so much to it. It has to become part of your practice protocol. And what I mean by that is, like, we're talking about failure, we're talking about focal points. It has to be incorporated into your practices so that you're teaching the boys not only to play, in my case, baseball, but also teaching them how to perform mentally during your practices.
Yeah. Jimmy, well, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm always a little surprised that, as you said, the mental approach to sports, whether it's baseball or any other sport, it really has to be part of the everyday routine that coaches learn and explain to their players. And Jimmy, I thank you for your call. I'm sorry we ran out of time this morning, but that's an important part. It really should be part of every coach's repertoire to explain the mental side of the kid's sport and how they should go about planning for it. Just a quick reminder, you can always hear a replay of my show by going to the podcast page on WFAN.com. Find the link for my show there, or you can go to my website, AskCoachWolf.com, and check and click on the blog for the show as well. Now, for next weekend, next Sunday's Sports Edge will be pre-recorded. In truth, I won't be here to take your calls, but I do have a good reason why. Next Saturday evening, my youngest daughter, Samantha, is getting married to a fine young man, Sean O'Connor. My wife, Trisha, and I couldn't be happier for Samantha. In any event, I don't miss many Sports Edge shows, but next Sunday is going to be a very special exception. My thanks this morning to Kevin Wall. Please stick around for NFL Preview. I'll talk to you down the road.
What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valeni and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.